after one alleged terrorist. Maybe you get him, maybe you don't, but at what price either way?
That's Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, and I played the wrong segment. So you'll have to listen tomorrow or go to Talk Nation Radio and find out that one thing she points out to was that the Bush 1 administration, in the lead up to the war, first war against Iraq, scolded the Yemenis and said that the most expensive vote they ever cast in the Security Council as the only Arab member was voting against the authorization of that attack, and the meager aid that was being given by the U.S. to Yemen was immediately rescinded for many years, and then we have a failed state. Okay, more on that anon tomorrow between 5 and 6. Time for the labor hour. It's past time for the labor hour, so let's go and see what's happening with the full cohort. No, I guess Bob's not here. Dave's here, though.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you on WEFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign and webcast worldwide at WEFT.org. The views and opinions here expressed are solely ours and do not represent those of WFT's board of directors or anyone else in a position of authority or management at WFT Radio. And now here's Tom with some underwriting announcements.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A Democratic Union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some news in this week's edition of the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week is one from his book, Live for Something or Die for Nothing. It is entitled Remembering Martin. Also here to us today is co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour all the way back from 1996 when it first went on the air, Bill Gorell. So now we're going to go to some headline news, and we're going to be, after that, dedicating our show to the remembrance of Dr. Martin Luther King, and covering a lot of things that you don't normally hear in the corporate media about Dr. King. And I think you're going to enjoy this show. We got some information that I just stumbled upon 2 years ago, and it's amazing how few people know about this. And it was involved a wrongful death suit filed by the King family against the United States government. But anyway, starting with our headline news, $747 billion for Iraq, $299 billion for Afghanistan. Congress has appropriated an additional $136.8 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for the 2010 fiscal year, in addition to the above. These new appropriations bring total war-related spending up to the $747.3 billion for Iraq and $299 billion for Afghanistan. The total amounts that have been spent on the war in both countries so far is over $1 trillion. These current year appropriations do not include funds to support the surge of 30,000 additional troops to Afghanistan proposed by the Obama administration on December 1, 2009. Conservative estimates suggest that it will cost approximately $30 billion to fund this surge.
According to a recruiting coordinator, the U.S. Census Bureau is having some difficulty finding census takers to work in East Central Illinois. Inside the 13-county East Central Illinois region, the shortage of Census Bureau workers is especially acute in rural Champaign County and in Vermilion, Payette, McLean, Coles, and Livingston counties. Most positions open are for census takers and field operations. Positions generally run 2 to 6 weeks with a part-time schedule of 20 to 40 hours a week. Most jobs require U.S. citizenship, a driver's license, use of a vehicle, and the ability to go door-to-door to interview residents. Applicants must be at least 18 years of age, have a valid Social Security number, pass a background check, and be able to speak, read, and write English. Tests for the positions, which pay between $11.50 and $18.25 an hour, will take place throughout the area in January and February. For information about testing times and locations in East Central Illinois, call 1-800-239-4408. That's 1-800-239-4408. Or go to the Census Bureau website at www.2010censusjobs.gov. That's www.2010censusjobs.gov.
With popular opposition to the Obama administration's health care plan growing, President Obama held a private White House meeting with leaders of the U.S. trade unions Monday to shore up support for the corporate-backed measure, which will roll back health care for tens of millions of working and retired people. A new CBS poll released Tuesday showed support for the bill has fallen to an all-time low of 35%. Nearly half the respondents criticized the legislation for failing to regulate the insurance industry. Among those attending the meeting with Obama was the new AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka, Teamsters President James P. Hoffa, and Gerald McKentry of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Trumka described the event as, quote, a meeting of friends trying to solve problems. The union executives reportedly urged Obama to trim back the unpopular proposal to tax the health care plans of millions of workers with employer-paid benefits. Obama shrugged off their pleadings and told the officials he continued to support the tax. which is included in the Senate version of the health care bill. The tax underscores the real meaning of health care reform. It is not aimed at expanding medical coverage, but cutting costs for the government and corporate America. This is exactly what the administration did to auto workers and their families at GM and Chrysler, including retirees who lost dental and optical coverage as part of the forced bankruptcy and restructuring of the two companies. This would tax the benefits of 31 million people, most of whom are not union members, but it also tax about a quarter of all union households. Trump addressed a gathering of the National Press Club where he made certain criticisms of the plan but made it clear that the AFL-CIO would continue to support the bill regardless. In his remarks, Trump indicated that workers on picket lines and workplaces around the country expressed their anger not only with the health care plan, which many see as a benefit to insurance and pharmaceutical companies and irresponsible employers, but it's all the difference of the government, the impact of rising unemployment and home foreclosures.
You know, Dave, I've met both Trumka and Hoffa. I liked Trumka. Hoffa, not so much.
Yeah. Okay. Trumka is a great speaker.
But, oh, yeah.
I mean, he's an excellent public speaker. And but the problem is like our friend Mike Griffin Decatur says that he's unfortunately pretty long on talk and little on action, you know.
Well, back when he was with the United Mine Workers, I heard some other things about him. There was a laborer used to sit up at the hall that used to be a mine worker. And back in, during the Pittston strike, his local sent him to Pittston, wherever that was. You know, it was in Virginia, mm-hmm. I believe. And anyway, he told me that he was kneeled down next to a road with Richard Trumka, throwing roofing nails out to the trucks that were coming in and out of the mine.
Oh, the scab trucks?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good to know that he's done some good things in the past anyway. But anyway, as I said earlier, this show today is going to be primarily dedicated to the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King. We're going to start off with a little...
Dave, yes. I got one little news story. I forgot to bring the magazine, but The Nation magazine, I know a lot of people listen to this program like James McMurtry, and they picked him as one of their MVPs, that is, Most Valuable Progressives.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, he's got, James McMurtry's got some excellent music and stuff. Okay, today we're going to be playing a lot of period music from the era that Dr. King was active in the civil rights movement. And we're going to be playing one song coming up here, House of the Rising Sun by Odetta. And then we're going to come back, and Tom Thomas is going to do the poem that he wrote several years ago, Remembering Martin.
There is a house in New Orleans. They call the rising sun. It's been on the ruin many poor girls. Look at me. If I had listened to what my mama said, I'd have been at home today. Being young, being foolish, I let my gambling lead me astray. My mama, she's a tailor. She sewed your blue jeans when they were new. My sweetheart is a drunkard, drinking down. When I was a young girl, I used to drink ale out of an alehouse into this jailhouse. My body is ruined. They left me here to die.
Okay, we now come to the portion of the program where we have Tom Thomas doing a poem that he wrote in dedication to Dr. Martin Luther King.
On the fourth day of the fourth month of the year 1968, a champion of justice fell, the victim of ignorant hate. He had a dream those years ago he tried to spread throughout the land, a dream of peace and parity for which he chose to speak and stand. He stood and spoke in many towns and marched with sisters and brothers and spread his words of peace and love, inspiring many others. He taught equality was right, while all bigotry is evil. No matter the shade of our skin, each and all of us are equal. Yet for the wisdom that he taught, J. Edgar Sniper shot him down the day he was preparing to march with strikers in Memphis town. He had a dream that marches on 4 long decades after he fell. It's in sight, but we're not there yet, not until in unity we dwell. What it was that Martin died for, each one of us must remember. Stand in solidarity, and our movements they can't dismember. Remembering Martin was originally written at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois, on January 19th of 2007, and it was first broadcast here January 20th of 2007. I think I've done it about twice more since then, including today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you, Tom. And now we're going to go to a little background on Dr. King. I want to mention that two shows previous to ours, it's on every Saturday morning here on WFT at 90.1 FM, Higher Ground, which is local activist John Lee Johnson's old program. We have it alternates between Carol and Aaron Ammons every other Saturday, and then Eunice Buckner Boone on the other Saturdays. But today it was Carol and Aaron's show. And they had a tribute to Dr. King as well. And I think they pointed out some really good information about Dr. King, is that, you know, the corporate media, of course, they try to package Dr. King into like what they want Americans to think about. And one of the things they do is to try to make Dr. King, although a great man he was, that he was the sole person who was responsible for the civil rights movement and all the activism to help poor people of all colors in this country. They cover up that latter part, of course, and just focus on the civil rights. Even though it's important, they still obscure the fact that in the last part of his last few years he was alive, that was going to be his next focus, was the poverty in the United States and the unjust economic system. But the thing they do is they try to put, and they do this a lot with people, it's part of this culture that they try to manipulate, is to think that it's not us working together collectively in groups of fives, tens, hundreds of thousands that get things changed for the better. That's it's just one extraordinary person that happens to come along once every half a century. And I want to thank Carol and Aaron for pointing that out, because that's very important for everyone to realize, is that, you know, nothing has ever changed for the better in this country or the world for that matter until people started getting organized. And Dr. King, and of course you have people like Dr. King that in these movements come forward as part of the leadership and becomes like the main spokesperson and the main person that people see that associate with that any particular movement. But anyway, check out their program on a regular basis at from 9 to 10 a.m. here on WFT 90.1 FM. So anyway, just to give a little background, of course, you're going to be hearing a lot of this information on a lot of the specials they're going to be having here in the next few days about Dr. King. But I just, you know, we got to kind of brush over him to give a little background here. So Martin Luther King Jr. was born on January 15th, 1929 in Atlanta, Georgia, and he was the son of Reverend Martin Luther King Sr. Growing up in Atlanta, King attended Booker T. Washington High School. He skipped 9th and 12th grade and entered Morehouse College at the age of 15. In 1948, he graduated from Morehouse College, and he began doctoral studies in systematic theology at Boston University and received his Doctor of Philosophy in June of 1955. Dr. King married Coretta Scott on June 18, 1953, and he became pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, when he was only 25 years old in 1925. Inspired by Mahatma Gandhi's success with nonviolent activism in India a decade and more previously, King actually visited the Gandhi family in India in 1959 with assistance from the Quaker group, the American Friends Service Committee. Mahatma Gandhi embodied in his life certain universal principles that are inherent in the most in the moral structure of the universe, and these principles are inescapable as the law of gravitation, as quoted Dr. King. And this, of course, was the whole principle of when a government is not serving its people and is creating injustice, the people have an absolute right to change that from active nonviolent resistance. And that's not passive, but active nonviolent resistance. In other words, shutting things down, boycotts, whatever it takes to get things changed nonviolently.
You'd be active by just sitting still.
Indeed. And all in one spot to block traffic or buildings or whatever the case. In the and case of the South, is lunch counters and other targets.
Spreading the idea that, hey, this land is our land.
Indeed. In March 1955, a 15-year-old schoolgirl, Claudette Colvin, refused to give up her bus seat to a white man in compliance with the Jim Crow law. Dr. King was on a committee from Birmingham African American Community that looked into the case. And then later in December 1955, Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to do the same thing. The Montgomery bus boycott began as a result of this, and the boycott lasted for 385 days, a little over a year. And the situation became so tense that Dr. King's house was bombed. Dr. King was arrested during this campaign, which ended with a United States District Court ruling in Browder versus Gale that ended racial segregation on all Montgomery public buses. In 1957, King, Ralph Abernathy, and other civil rights activists founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The group was created to harness the moral authority and organizing power of black churches to conduct nonviolent protests in the service of civil rights reform. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference applied the principles of nonviolent protest with great success by strategically choosing the method of protest and the places in which the protests were carried out. These were often dramatic standoffs with segregation authorities. Sometimes these confrontations turned violent. The Birmingham campaign was a strategic effort by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to promote civil rights for African Americans, and its goal was to end the city's segregated civil and discriminatory economic policies. The campaign lasted for more than 2 months in the spring of 1963. To provoke the police into filling the city's jails to overflowing. King and black citizens of Birmingham employed nonviolent tactics to flout the laws they considered unjust. King summarized the philosophy of the Birmingham campaign when he said, "The purpose of direct action is to create a situation so crisis-packed that it will inevitably open the door to negotiation." Protests in Birmingham began with a boycott to pressure businesses to sales jobs and other employment to people of all races, as well as to end segregated facilities in the stores. When business leaders resisted the boycott, King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference began what they termed Project C, a series of sit-ins and marches intended to provoke arrest. After the campaign ran low on adult volunteers, it recruited children for what became known as the Children's Crusade. During the protests, the Birmingham Police Department, led by Eugene Bull Connor, used high-pressure water jets and police dogs to control protesters, including children. By the end of the campaign, King's reputation improved immensely. Connor lost his job, the Jim Crow signs in Birmingham came down, and public places became open to blacks. King's representing Southern Christian Leadership Conference was among the leaders of the so-called Big Six Civil Rights Organization, who a few years later were instrumental in the organization of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. A. Philip Randolph, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters president, who was very much involved in the civil rights movement going all the way back in the 19-teens, was also involved in this. President John Kennedy initially opposed the march outright because he was concerned it would negatively impact the drive for passage of civil rights legislation, but the organizers were firm that the march would proceed anyway. The march did, However, it made specific demands. It ended racial desegregation in public schools, meaningful civil rights legislation, including a law prohibiting racial discrimination in employment, protection of civil rights workers from police brutality, a $2 minimum wage for all workers, and self-government for Washington, D.C. Despite tensions, the march was a resounding success. More than 250,000 people of diverse ethnicities attended the event, sprawling from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial onto the National Mall and around the reflecting pool. At the time, it was the largest gathering of protesters in Washington, D.C.'s history. Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech electrified the crowd. Okay. The struggle continued, and of course, later on, King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, in partial collaborations with other organizations, organized a march from Selma to the state capital of Montgomery in March of 1965. The first attempt to march on March 7th was aborted because of mob and police violence against the demonstrators. Footage of police brutality against the protesters was broadcast extensively and aroused national public outrage and against the police and authorities in sympathy for the civil rights marchers. King's next attempt to organize the march on March 9th, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference petitioned for an injunction in federal court against the state of Alabama. This was denied, and the march proceeded anyway. And then, of course, later in Dr. King's career in 1966, he came north to Chicago to organize in the poor and black communities, and faced horrible opposition from Mayor Daley at that time, including massive mob crowds coming out and confronting Dr. King, throwing bricks and bottles. And in fact, Dr. King, at one point, there's some actual news footage of it getting hit in the head with a brick. Dr. King later remarked that Chicago, he saw some of the worst faces of racism in Chicago that pale anything he'd seen prior in the U.S. South. Anyway, but starting in 1965, Dr. King began to express doubts about the United States' role in the Vietnam War. In an April 4th, 1967 appearance at the New York City Riverside Church, exactly 1 year before his death, Dr. King delivered a speech titled Beyond Vietnam. In the speech, he spoke strongly against the U.S. role in the war, insisting that the U.S. was in Vietnam to, quote, occupy it as an American colony, and calling the U.S. government, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. He also argued that the country needed larger and broader moral changes. King also was opposed to the Vietnam War on the grounds that the war took money and resources that could have been spent here in the United States on social welfare services like the war on poverty. He is quoted to say that a nation that continues year after year to spend money on military defense and war than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Of course, I remember this growing up too, but after the Riverside Church in particular, the corporate media viciously attacked Dr. King. Life magazine called his speech at Riverside Church, quote, demonic slander that sounded like a script for Radio Hanoi, and the Washington Post declared that King had, quote, diminished his usefulness to his cause, his country, and his people.
Hey, Dave.
Yes.
Here's somebody on Facebook. This is a thread that doesn't have anything to do with the show, but he claims that Dr. King was a Republican, which would make sense because up until the 1960s, the mid-1960s, the Democrats were the party of segregation.
In the South.
Yeah, definitely in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, later on, then I recognized that John L. Lewis was a Republican and that Teddy Roosevelt was progressive and John Lindsay was pretty cool, if mm-hmm. people remember him.
The old mayor of New York City.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then I said it's too bad that the party's been taken over by right-wing ideologues. And then this guy comes back. It hasn't been. Even Bush was a moderate. We need conservatives to get the party back. It's too bad the Democrat Party – Democrat Party has been taken over by leftist, radical Marxists and socialists.
Uh-huh. I'd like him to define exactly what leftist, radicals, and Marxists are.
Oh, we could only wish.
Well, I'm just saying, I would like to know what this person's definition of a leftist, Marxist, or what radical is.
Well, no, this is the kind of person who would consider social anything. Probably public roads are socialist.
Uh-huh.
You know, to this person, okay, we'll give up the army, we'll give up the police department, we'll privatize everything, and if you want to be defended, then you can pay for it. Well, and if you want a road and you want to put it in front of my house, you know, then I'm not going to let you. Well, because it's my property.
What I've noticed is these people tend to, they want to keep the military. They want to keep the police. That's the only thing they want to keep public.
Yeah, the socialist fire department.
Yeah.
You know, you want to go back to the old days, like in the movie The Gangs in New York, where the gangs were based around the fire companies. And if you didn't have a medallion above your door,
they let your house
burned.
Mm-hmm. Yes, God, indeed.
I just can't.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm betting you that this person, if he'd have lived in the 1960s, he would have been adamantly opposed to Dr. King and the civil rights movement.
Yeah, and here's another one, too. This is before, you know, your responses get mixed up here because you're typing while the other one is.
On Facebook you're talking about. This
yeah,
is what you're
Facebook.
Getting this from.
Uh-huh. And see, I'm talking about then pointing out that Nixon used wage and price controls. OSHA and the EPA came in under his aegis, and he proposed a minimum income. And it was $5,000, and in the early 70s, $5,000 was a pretty good chunk of money.
Maybe about $20,000 in today's money.
Yeah. You know, it's just, and this guy, and he doesn't think the Republican Party's conservative enough. He thinks George Bush was a moderate, you know? You know why they say that? It's because Bush did end up spending so much money on his idiotic wars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, again, I said that this person was alive back in the 1960s. I can bet you that they would have voted for George Wallace for president.
Yeah, they wouldn't have voted Republican. They would have voted for Wallace.
Yeah. Well, anyway, just to continue here, in 1968, King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference organized the Poor People's Campaign to address issues of economic justice. The campaign culminated in a march on Washington, D.C., demanding economic aid to the poorest communities of the United States. King traveled the country to assemble a multiracial army of the poor that would march on Washington to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience at the Capitol until Congress created a Bill of Rights for poor Americans. That is, they were going to shut down the nation's capital until economic justice started to be implemented in the United States. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference called on the government of the United States to invest in rebuilding America's cities. He felt that Congress had shown, quote, hostility to the poor by spending military funds so generously. His vision was for change that was more revolutionary than mere reform. He cited a systemic flaw of racism, poverty, militarism, and materialism, and argued that reconstruction of society itself is the real issue to be faced.
Well, aren't we at that point right now?
Indeed. You know, Bill, this is what's interesting. Doing this research on Dr. King, and especially the Riverside Church speech that he gave 1 year to the day before his murder, which Thomas, of course, is going to be reading a little concise version of that later in the show. It is amazing how 43 years later, these issues and these points that Dr. King made are still relevant, unfortunately. I mean, we should have moved way beyond this by now. We haven't evolved in this society for over 40 years, and we keep the same people are in power and run their show as opposed to the citizens of this country. Anyway, on March 29, 1968, Dr. King went to Memphis, Tennessee in support of the black sanitary public workers employees represented by AFSCME Local 1733, who had been on strike since March 12th for higher wages and better treatment. On April 3rd, Dr. King addressed a rally and delivered his I've Been to the Mountaintop address at Mason Temple. Then on April 4th, the next day at 6:01 p.m., while Dr. King was standing on the Lorraine Motel's second floor balcony, he was murdered by a sniper. After emergency chest surgery, Dr. King was pronounced dead at St. Joseph's Hospital at 7:05 p.m. The assassination led to a nationwide wave of riots in more than 100 cities. The city of Memphis, it was interesting, though, that shortly after Dr. King's murder, the city of Memphis quickly settled the strike with the sanitation workers on terms favorable to the sanitation workers. 2 months after Dr. King's death, escaped convict James Earl Ray was captured at London Heathrow Airport or trying to leave the United Kingdom on a false Canadian passport in the name of Ramon George Snyde on his way to the white-ruled Rhodesia, which, of course, is now Zimbabwe. Ray was quickly extradited to Tennessee and charged with Dr. King's murder. He confessed to the assassination on March 10, 1969, though he recanted his confession 3 days later. On the advice of his attorney, Percy Forman, Ray pleaded guilty to avoid a trial conviction and thus the possibility of receiving the death penalty. Ray was sentenced to a 99-year prison term. Ray claimed that a man he met in Montreal, Quebec, with the alias Raoul, was involved in the assassination and was part of the conspiracy to murder Dr. King. He spent the James Earl Ray spent the remainder of his life attempting unsuccessfully to withdraw his guilty plea and secure the trial he never had. Ray's lawyers maintain he was a scapegoat. One of the claims used to support this assertion is Ray's confession was given under pressure and he had been threatened with the death penalty. Ray was a thief and a burglar, but he had no record of committing violent crimes with a weapon, nor had ever served in the military. The two separate ballistic tests done on the Remington Game Master rifle recovered by police had neither conclusively proved Ray had been the killer, nor had it even been proven that this was the murder weapon. Moreover, witnesses surrounding Dr. King at the moment of his death say the shot came from another location other than the boarding house. It came from behind a thick shrubbery near the rooming house, which had been inexplicably cut away in the days following the assassination. Anyway, it's interesting how this days after the assassination, the police go there with sanitation workers and basically wipe clean a crime scene where there might have been spent bullet cartridges. Anyway, in 1997, Dr. King's son, Dexter Scott King, met with James Earl Ray and publicly supported Ray's efforts to obtain a new trial. 2 years later, Coretta Scott King, King's widow, along with the rest of the King family, won a wrongful death claim against Lloyd Jowers and other unknown co-conspirators. Jowers claimed he had received $100,000 to arrange King's assassination. The jury of six white and six blacks found Jowers guilty, and the government agencies were part of the assassination. William F. Pepper represented the King family in the trial. We're going to be talking about that more in detail in a later part of the program. But anyway, in 2004, Jesse Jackson, who was at King's side at the time of his death, noted, "The fact is there were saboteurs to disrupt the march and within our own organization. We found a very key person who was on the government's payroll, so infiltration within, saboteurs from without, and the press attacks as well. I will never believe that James Earl Ray had the motive, the money, or the ability to have done this murder himself. He is in his belief that the government was very much involved in the stage, and I think the escape route for James Earl Ray that was provided for him." And you got to ask the question, how was a petty thief able to get a passport to get all the way, and the money to get to London, England, and then get a fake Canadian passport and then get ready to go to Rhodesia, which at that time was a white racist government?
Somebody sounds like was paying for it.
Sounds like I bet Osama bin Laden was behind it.
Oh, yes, of course. But anyway, we would like to now go to Tom Thomas here. Well, pretty soon we're going to play, just take a real quick short music break.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yes.
Laura Flanders says, "What kind of world, what kind of life? After years of earning 38 cents an hour in sweatshops, the New York Times say Haitians earn $100 a day pulling corpses."
We're going to be talking a little bit about Haiti, too, coming up to our public service analysis segment. But anyway, I'm going to play a little song here real quick from the era that Dr. King lived and worked. And then we're going to be back with Tom Thomas and doing an excerpt from the Riverside Church speech that Dr. King gave 1 year to the day before his death. And that many believe might have been the reason why the government began to think about murdering him.
Before
Okay, and now a reading from Tom Thomas with a synopsis of Dr. King's famous April 4th, 1967 Riverside Church speech.
I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. The recent statements of your executive committee are the sentiments of my own heart, and I find myself in full accord when I read its opening line, "A time comes when silence is betrayal." That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often the vocation of agony, but we must speak. There is at the outset a very obvious connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle that I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. Then came the buildup in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken and eviscerated as if it were some idle plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of our poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continue to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps the most tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking young black men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia or East Harlem. We have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. We watched them in brutal solidarity burning the huts of a poor village, but we realized that they would never live on the same block in Detroit. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. However, in spite of being outspoken, the only change came from America, increasing troop commitments in order to support the governments which were singularly corrupt, inept, and without popular support. The Vietnamese people read our leaflets and received regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us, not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They move sadly and apathetically as we heard them off the land of their fathers into concentration camps where minimal social needs are rarely met. They know they must move or be destroyed by our bombs. So they go, primarily women and children and the aged. They watch as we poison their water, as we kill 1 million acres of their crops. They must weep as the bulldozers roll through their villages preparing to destroy the precious trees. What do the peasants think as we ally ourselves with the landlords and as we refuse to put any action into our many words concerning land reform? What do they think as we test our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe? Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as an American to the leaders of my own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours. The words of the late John F. Kennedy come back to haunt us. He said, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." Increasingly, by choice or by accident, this is the whole role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolution impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and pleasures that come from the immense profits of overseas investments. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from being a thing-oriented society to being a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. The business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of people normally humane, of sending men home from dark and lonely bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs for social uplift is approaching spiritual death. We are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. We must move past indecision to action. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to a long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. And exactly 1 year to the day after Dr. Martin Luther King made this speech, he was murdered by J. Edgar Sniper.
Thank you, Tom.
Oh, I got some I'd like to read, too.
Can I say something real quick,
okay,
Bill?
Okay, go ahead.
What's really interesting, substitute the word Afghanistan for Vietnam.
Absolutely.
And we have the exact same situation today, 43 years later. And I just want to urge President Obama, listen to Dr. King's words. Quit serving those people who oppose Dr. King and start listening and serving the people.
Okay, this is a letter from Satan to Pat Robertson regarding his statements on Haiti. Dear Pat Robertson, I know that you know all press is good press, so I appreciate the shout out. And you make God look like a big mean bully who kicks people when they are down, so I'm all over that action. But when you say that Haiti has made a pact with me, it's totally humiliating. I may be evil incarnate, but I'm no welcher. The way you put it, making a deal with me leaves folks desperate and impoverished. Sure, in the afterlife, but when I strike bargains with people, they first get something here on earth. Glamour, beauty, talent, wealth, fame, glory, a golden fiddle. Those Haitians have nothing, and I mean nothing, and that was before the earthquake. Haven't you seen Crossroads or Damn Yankees? If I had one thing going with Haiti, there'd be lots of banks, skyscrapers, SUVs, exclusive nightclubs, Botox, that kind of thing. And 80% poverty rate is not my style. Nothing against it. I'm just saying not how I roll. You're doing great work, Pat, and I don't want to clip your wings. Just come on. You're making me look bad. And not the good kind of bad. Keep blaming God. That's working. But leave me out of it, please. Or we may need to negotiate your own contract.
Oh.
Best Satan. Yeah. That's actually written by a woman named Lily Coyle from Minneapolis, I believe. It was published in the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
She sounds like a very perceptive lady.
Yeah, and I got it off, there's a link on Facebook to www.npr.org blogs. And then you can find it from there if you want.
Yes, Pat Robertson pretends to be a man of God, but I think this pretty well summed it up.
Well, if you take in the fact that God is the almighty dollar, then Pat Robertson's a man of God.
What do the Hebrews call the worship of the God of money or gold? Mammon? Well,
Mammon.
Mammon.
Mammon, yeah.
Yes. Pat Robertson worships Mammon. That's for sure. Speaking of Haiti, this is from the Industrial Workers of the World in Chicago. A devastating 7.0 earthquake hit Haiti today, Tuesday, January 12th. Thousands have been killed and much of Port-au-Prince is leveled. This follows a series of deadly hurricanes in late 2008 and decades of foreign-influenced economic terrorism, culminating in a U.S.-led invasion and coup in 2004 and continuing U.N. occupation. Haiti, the poorest colonial nation in the Western Hemisphere, is the only country to successfully liberate itself from slavery, and the former colonial masters have not let that be forgotten. Most people live on less than $2 a day, and many on less than $1. In April 2008, representatives of ISC, which is the IWW's International Solidarity Commission, participated in an IWW delegation to Haiti, where they met with workers and peasants struggling against neoliberal slavery. We pledged our continued support to their struggle, and fellow workers donated generously to support their organizing and again for aid following the hurricane. Currently, communications with Haiti are nearly impossible, but no doubt they will need our help again. The delegation made a short video about their trip called Haiti's Tourniquet, which we're selling for $15, includes shipping, to raise money for our comrades in Haiti, and any donations, large or small, are greatly appreciated. You can purchase these videos and make donations to, you can send it to P.O. Box 31909, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19104, in care of the IWW. Again, that's P.O. Box 31909, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19104. And so your money will be going not only to help people in Haiti feed themselves and survive, but it'll also help them through the IWW to get organized so they can get higher wages. Plus, you get this great video in return. Tom, you saw something on the news this morning. Can you share that with us about Haiti?
They broke into the regular broadcast for a special news broadcast. It was the Three Stooges. Obama, Clinton, and Bush were all up there, I guess, on the front step of the White House saying what great things we're going to do for Haiti. But the one thing that struck me about their little appearance was Bush was the first to speak.
And this is George W. Bush, the last president before Obama, okay?
Yeah, and the very first thing that he said was, the people down there need blankets and water. Don't worry about sending them blanks and water. Just send your cash to us.
Unbelievable.
What?
Unbelievable.
Don't worry about blankets and water. Send us your cash. No.
Oh, did you guys hear about what Rush Limbaugh was saying?
No.
Okay, Rush Limbaugh, this day or two ago, he was on the air. And anyway, Obama urged people to go to whatever.gov that his administration has. And then they could find a page there that showed places where they could donate, which is similar to what the Bush administration mm-hmm. did many times. Well, anyway, what happened? Rush Limbaugh is saying that Obama's just going to take the money and then he's going to just get your name for his mailing list.
That's pretty cynical, you know. I don't trust the U.S. government, and I don't particularly even trust corporate organizations that I donate money to. But that is just outright, as usual. What do you expect from Rush Limbaugh? Anyway, a little music break here. We're going to come back and talk about the wrongful death suit brought by the King family against the United States government back in the 1990s.
Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer. For only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Yes, tell me what's going on. And today in Champaign-Urbana from 2 to 4 p.m., there'll be the first Saturday of the month vigil against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, sponsored by the anti-war and racism effort here in Champaign-Urbana. And that'll be at the corner of Neal and Main Street in downtown Champaign. That's from 2 to 4 p.m. Also, don't forget, tomorrow, check out Labor's View Television from 4 to 5 p.m. It'll be tomorrow, and it's on every Sunday from 4 to 5 on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6. And tomorrow's show will be showing the concise version of the film, Why We Fight. And I'll be discussing about why is it that the majority of the American people don't want these wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, yet they continue to go on and expand. Also, check out on the internet a really good information source on lots of issues, particular issues of the black community. It's called blackagendareport.com. That's blackagendareport.com. Okay.
Oh, by the way, Dave, isn't there a meeting this afternoon that...
Yes,
people might be interested in?
Yes. The local Central Illinois branch of the Industrial Workers of the World will be meeting at the Urbana Post Office Building, 202 South Broadway, in the basement family room. And that meeting starts at 12:30, and all workers are welcome. Okay, we don't have much time here, unfortunately. Gosh, it's just amazing how the time is flowing today. But anyway, this is something that is really interesting. I just stumbled across this 2 years ago. This article, you can actually access, if you go on and you type in Google, the Martin Luther King wrongful death trial, you'll pull up this thing by Jim Douglas from Probe Magazine in the spring of 2000. Just to hit on some of the highlights here, and you can go, of course, and read the full article. According to a Memphis jury's verdict on December 8th, 1999, in the wrongful death lawsuit of the King family versus Lloyd Jowers and other unknown conspirators, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated by a conspiracy that included agencies of his own government. Almost at this time, 32 years after King's murder through Lame Motel in Memphis on April 4, 1968, a court extended the circle of responsibility for the assassination beyond the late scapegoat James Earl Ray to the United States government. And what this reporter mentions is, I can't hardly believe the fact that apart from the courtroom participants, only Memphis TV reporter Wendell Stacy and I attended from beginning to end this historic 3.5-week trial. So there was a total corporate media blackout on this civil trial, which would be, I mean, this is amazing how, you know, that this could even be ignored. He goes on to say, what I experienced in that courtroom ranged from inspiration at the courage of the Kings, their lawyer investigator William F. Pepper, and the witnesses, to amazement at the U.S. government's carefully interwoven plot to murder Dr. King. In the complaint filed by the King family, King versus Jowers and other unknown conspirators, the only named defendant, Lloyd Jowers, was never their primary concern. As soon as it became evident in court, the real defendants were the anonymous co-conspirators who stood in the shadows behind Jowers, who was a former owner of the Memphis Bar and Grill. The Kings and Pepper were, in effect, charging U.S. intelligence agencies, particularly the FBI and U.S. Army intelligence, with organizing, subcontracting, and covering up the assassination. I mean, this is really powerful stuff. I mean, and hardly anybody knows about it. They had to do this in civil court, because the government's what they call the U.S. government's sovereign immunity, it is not possible to put a U.S. intelligence agency on trial in a U.S. criminal court. Such a step would require authorization by the federal government, which is not likely to indict itself. Thanks to the conjunction of a civil court, however, an independent judge with a sense of history and a courageous family and lawyer were able to accomplish this. In the end, 12 jurors, 6 black and 6 white, said to everyone willing to hear, the U.S. government is guilty as charged. This is just an incredible story, and the reason I'm bringing this up, of course, you know, it's amazing how the corporate media has most people in this country programmed now. As soon as anybody makes any kind of statement about any kind of government misdeeds or corporate misdeeds, the automatic knee-jerk response is conspiracy theorists. Well, you know, this is a programmed, brainwashed response, because the thing is that a lot of times the government has done wrong. There's plenty of evidence on this, and that's the whole point. There's a difference between a conspiracy theory and conspiracy fact. I mean, come on, is this as if people in power don't talk to each other, and people in power in both government and corporations in the history of this country have never colluded to doing wrong against the citizens of this country? I mean, I'd like anybody to prove that to be the case. But anyway, it's interesting because they also, part of this wrongful death suit also mentioned several individuals in the Memphis Police Department. And it takes you through the whole story and everything. And I mean, it's really incredible. And unfortunately, we don't have the time to go through it all.
Well, Dave, you know, it seems like people on the left are really paranoid about conspiracy theory. I've always found that really amazing. They say the reason it is because it takes away from the systemic, looking at the system and changing the system. And I think that if you can prove that people are being really evil and conspiring and doing these terrible things, well, that definitely shows that the system's not good.
Well, indeed, Bill, I feel the same way. And I'll tell you what, though, this cuts across political lines. I mean, you know, there's people out there that I think are uncomfortable with the subject. I think that it bothers them. I don't think they want to think about these sort of things. But we must know what our government's done against us and what they continue to do against our will. You know, the thing is this country was founded as a republic, not an empire. But I'm afraid we no longer have an American republic. We have an empire. But anyway, again, thank you so much for tuning in to the Illinois World Labor Hour. I hope you enjoyed this tribute to Dr. King, and we really need to heed his words 43 years later.
And get rid of the imperialistic empire.
Indeed. We need to return to a republic in this country that's controlled by the citizens and not the corporate interests. Okay, so tune in next Saturday. For